So yeah, we so Shane and I will be. I was talking about the standard model from non-commutative geometry. What, why, and what's new? And somehow the subtitle of this could be "Coming to Grips with." Bruder, Beezy, Bitsy, how do you pronounce your last name? Beezy. Okay, sorry, yeah. And Besnard. So in other words, yeah, I mean somehow as a, just to set the stage for as a moment of for a moment before diving in, somehow the general context here is that, okay, so science has produced for us so far what we know about the laws of nature, and our best attempt to summarize it boils down to some formula, which is the Lagrangian for the standard model of particle physics plus general relativity, and then some rules called quantum mechanics for, if I give you a formula like this, what are you supposed to do with it? How do you turn it into physical predictions and observable predictions? And the question is just what, why? Where did this thing come from? Where did this formula come from? Where did those rules come from? And since the early 90s, there has been a line of argument suggesting, a sort of developing line of argument suggesting that non-commutative geometry could be a better approach, a more suitable approach for answering some of these questions than standard Riemannian geometry, a better sort of setting. Yeah, I guess this dates back at least, I should have written, I should have tried to, well, anyway, this is, I'm going to mess up in terms of references here, but this dates back at least to papers in the early 90s by Kahn and Lott, and then from the mid-90s until the present, there have been a bunch of important contributions by Kahn and Shamsuddin, and then there were two of the key contributions are due to people in the room here. There's a 2006 paper by John Barrett, and also a 2006 paper by Matilda with Kahn and Shamsuddin, and. Yeah, so anyway, I apologize. I'm probably forgetting things here. So just to say that, so then last year, Shane and I had, over the past year, Shane and I have written two papers suggesting a reformulation of this story, which some of you have probably heard me talk about and others not. Somehow the one sentence summary is that we rephrase the whole thing in terms of an algebra that we define that we call B. And so there are a lot of advantages, it turns out, to doing this. Mathematically speaking, well, I'll get to this a little bit more later. There are mathematical advantages, most notably that you condense the formalism a lot, that there are sort of a lot of moving pieces in the traditional formulation of this, a lot of bits of structure and axioms and assumptions. And over here, if you just assume that B is a graded star algebra, that reproduces a long list of the bits of structure and axioms and assumptions that you usually have to put in piecemeal over here. And then it also fixes a bunch of physical problems, traditional problems that had plagued the physical construction of the standard model in non-commutative geometry. Anyway, so sounds like we would give it a grade A. But I will give it only a B plus if you want. No pun intended. So there were two nagging problems that Shane and I were stuck on about this, and yeah, and hadn't been able to solve. And then a month ago, we got this paper in the mail from Bruder, Beatty, and Besnard, who give a beautiful resolution of the problem. Basically, show that the two problems resolve each other. And so that's a big, that was a big step forward, and so we've been ever since then trying to sort of come to grips with that sort of key insight, repackage it in our own way, and we'll have a paper in the next couple of days going through that more systematically if you're interested. But here I just want to get across a couple first of all, I just want to unpackage that story I just told a little bit, and then we will, Shane and I will try to explain some of the sort of key ideas. And you know, even though the fix here looks simple in retrospect, once you do it, you know, the new package looks, you know, suggests things that the old one didn't. And so I want to tell you about that also for what to do next. Okay, so let's see. The next thing I wanted to do, just to sort of conceptually clarify things, you know, there's two threads of non-commutative geometry in physics that it's important to keep separate. Okay, one, the far more common thing, far more common way that non-commutative geometry has been discussed in the physics literature, is as a kind of speculation about what space-time might be like at the Planck scale. Okay, so this is some, in one way or another, it's a thought about how the smooth structure of space-time might become fuzzed out by quantum gravity in much the same way as phase space is fuzzed out by quantum gravity. And in particular, there's a very large string theory literature in which it's string theory really does this explicitly, both. And in a context where you can really explore it, and in the context of real quantum gravity theory, and so that there's a very big literature on that one way or another. But this is really something different that I'll be talking about today. This is more non-commutative geometry, you know, in your face, you might say. That, you know, the picture here is supposed to be that the world you see around you, the structure that it has, the stuff we already observe around us, is already crying out to you that the space-time that you live in is non-commutative. In other words, the reason why instead of just the metric, we see gauge bosons and scalar fields, and the reason why instead of just one fermion, we see a weird assortment of fermions with weird charges, that is supposed to be a reflection of a small amount of non-commutativity in the space-time in this interpretation. You know, so in that case, I kind of like to give the analogy with the goal here is somehow for me analogous to Minkowski. In other words, what Minkowski did. So Einstein discovered special relativity, but he had it phrased in terms of these algebraic formula for, you know, if your clocks and rulers read coordinates x and t, and I speed by you, and mine read coordinates x prime and t prime, you know, how are they related? And he had these algebraic formula, but not a real geometric interpretation. And Minkowski came along and said, oh, well, you know, those formula look kind of gross. They have these square root of 1 over 1 minus b squared over c squared inside them. And, you know, there's actually a much nicer interpretation of that. We all just live in a four-dimensional space-time endowed with a Minkowski metric. And Einstein's initial reaction to this was, roughly speaking, you know, all these mathematicians, they take things that are, you know, we physicists already understand well, and they make them incomprehensible to us. Like, they somehow just have to make everything more complicated. But then in retrospect, you know, somehow, even if it was just a reformulation at that time, which I want to stress that this part of the analogy is not the part I want to stress. I want to say it's not quite just a reformulation what we're doing here. It's better than that. But even if it was just that, it was sort of finding the natural geometric setting that explained the known facts at that time was, in that case, you know, a crucial part of the road forward. And so the hope is that something similar is true here. Okay, so then I want to move on to stage two of the title, non-commutative geometry, what? So in light of time, this is going to be the fastest non-commutative geometry what I've ever done. So I just want to say briefly the following. So in normal differential geometry, you give a geometry as follows. You first basically tell the topological structure of the space you're working on, the manifold M, you give the manifold, and then you put a metric on it. You give G mu nu, and then you can define lengths and angles and do geometry. Okay? So the idea in non-commutative geometry is based on, basically it's based on this thing that people realized in the middle of the 20th century that commutative algebras, okay, sorry, I'll explain what an algebra is in a second, but just, so ordinary commutative algebras, like the algebras of functions, are in one-to-one correspondence with topological spaces. So if you give me a topological space, there's an algebra associated with that, which is the algebra of functions over that space. But basically, you can go backwards, okay, that given any commutative algebra, that you can, the algebra contains within it what the topological space is that it lives over, okay? So it's really a dual encoding of this topological space. And the idea of non-commutative geometry is to do the following. Instead of talking about topological spaces directly, let's go over to this dual encoding, and then voila, suddenly, if we rephrase things on this side, it makes sense to let this algebra A become non-commutative, and then suddenly we're doing something more general than what we were doing before. Something that we wouldn't have been able to phrase over here, we suddenly can phrase over here. Okay, so over here, part of the data you give is an algebra, which roughly speaking you can think of as analogous to giving the topological space. And then to give the metric information, to turn this thing into a geometry, you give some sort of differential operator that interacts with these functions. Okay? So in the canonical case, this will literally be the curve space Dirac operator. And you can see in that case that carries the metric information, because you know that d squared is the Laplacian, which is really just, so somehow d knows about the metric on the space. So that's the sense in which this is encoding that information. And then these things, they interact on something. They interact on a Hilbert space in which they're both represented. Okay, so this is the input data that you give in non-commutative geometry. The idea of non-commutative geometry is to rephrase differential geometry in terms of this data, and then see how far you can get by generalizing, by letting A become non-commutative. What? What structure? Smooth structure. Well, so yeah, if you want a smooth manifold, if you want a smooth commutative manifold, then over here what you would take is the algebra of smooth functions over that manifold. That's the thing. If you restrict not, so, right. So in other words, if you put some, ask a mathematician that question. I believe the answer I just gave you is correct, but my real answer is, where's Masoud? That's my real answer. Okay, so yeah, so that's I think that's all I was going to say about non-commutative geometry. What? So you don't feel like experts, I know, at this point, but nevertheless, I'm going to plunge forward. So, non-commutative geometry. Why? Okay, so again, in the interest of being brief here, I will say the following. I categorize the reasons for to be interested in non-commutative geometry as falling into three categories. The fancy reasons, by which I mean reasons that mathematicians are interested in,
so you recover a unique metric or the eigenvalues of D or something like that?
So there is a reconstruction theorem given all of this data that you can if you take the canonical choices here, the algebra of smooth functions, the canonical curve space Dirac operator, and the all both represented on the Hilbert space of spinners, that then you can reconstruct the manifold, and then Yeah, in the continuous case, there is a theorem to that effect. I don't think you can do it just from the spectrum.
I mean, a while ago, it only worked for the Riemannian metric.
That's true. Definitely, the reconstruction theorem only works in the Riemannian case. And also, there's a bunch of things that I'll say that, you know, it's maybe not clear if they work in the Riemannian case or more general signatures, but in almost all cases, they've only really been shown to be true in the Riemannian case. No, I don't think it's tied to 4D. No, this reconstruction theorem, you mean?
I have no idea.
Who knows? I doubt it. Yeah. I think. Yes, that's right. It needs to be. I think it's for Euclidean signature compact spin manifolds of any dimension. But again, my general philosophy has been to mostly ignore any. I'm a big one for ignoring things. What can I say? I just don't like real analysis very much. That's basically what I mean. I'm hoping some of those real analysis questions won't turn out to be killers. So I was going to say I'm really giving the impression that I have a lot of disdain for pure mathematics, which is not true at all. But so anyway, I gave this. I'm just to be funny, calling those the fancy reasons, meaning that there are reasons that this has been a big topic of study in pure mathematics because it's regarded as a kind of interesting generalization of Riemannian geometry, and a lot of non-trivial theorems in Riemannian geometry extend naturally and non-trivially to this extended setup. So people are pure mathematicians are just interested in its own right. Then I would say there's also deep reasons. And again, I don't really want to get sidetracked here, but I recommend looking at there are some nice review articles by Kahn that you can find on his webpage or some conference proceedings on the archive, and he does a good job of describing these. My 5-minute elevator pitch is what I want to give, and it's a much more concrete thing about where the rubber meets the road, if you want, which is that I think it does a more economical job of accounting for the structure of the standard model. So I just want to roughly sketch what I mean by that. So let's do a head-to-head comparison of how you would construct the standard model Lagrangian in the usual way, if you were just working in the context of ordinary gauge theory versus in non-commutative geometry. So in the usual gauge theory approach, there's a three-step process. You have to choose the symmetry group. So in particular, you have to choose the gauge group. So you choose SU3 times SU2 times U1. And that fixes what gauge bosons are present and how they transform under this gauge group. But then you have to also choose the fermions. What fermions are present and what their representations are. So we have to make a little table here that we give as input before we can write down the Lagrangian. And so we're going to just give as an input that the fermions in one generation are the up and down left-handed quarks and the up right-handed, the down right-handed, the left-handed quark doublet, the left-handed neutrino, I'm sorry, the right-handed neutrino, and the right-handed electron. And then I need to tell you what all their charges are. So I need to tell you that, that the quarks are all triplets under SU3, and the leptons are all singlets, and the left-handed guys are doublets, and the right-handed guys are singlets, and then I have to tell you they're hypercharges. And now, as you may know, their hypercharges are constrained. So the table is not totally free, because there's some constraint coming from the cancellation of chiral anomalies, but in any case, it's much more well. So we'll compare it. We'll compare it in a moment. And then finally, we're not done yet. I still have to tell you what the scalar fields are. So I have to tell you, in particular, that there is just one scalar field H. That's just an arbitrary input in the standard model, and that it has some particular charges. It's a doublet under SU2 and has hypercharge 1/2. Okay. Once I've told you that, now in effective field theory, you just go off, take those fields, write down every term you can write down, built from these fields consistent with those symmetries, and that's your Lagrangian. So that's the algorithm in the normal approach. And so, what's the algorithm on this side? On this side, I start by specifying the algebra A. Okay, so to get the standard model in particular, I end up having to choose some algebra So this is, in other words, the algebra that I'll take is the complex numbers plus the quaternions plus the 3x3 complex matrices. And so really, these two steps are parallel. Here's, you know, I've really chosen this algebra so that, roughly speaking, its automorphism group is going to be this, going to be the symmetry group that I want to get. Yeah, that's true. That's right. This is all going to be multiplied by the canonical spectral triple that gives Riemannian geometry. So it's all going to be multiplied by, there's a small finite geometry that I'm going to append to the continuous geometry, normal commutative spacetime. Step two, I have to represent this. I have to give the representation of this algebra on this Hilbert space. And so, so that representation has to satisfy some criteria. But anyway, the bottom line is it ends up for, you know, if I choose a given element here, I have to give a matrix. I'm gonna tell you a 96 by 96 matrix in which I put these elements and they act on a 96 component. Hilbert space, 96, because 96 is the number of fermions in the standard model, including left and right-handedness and particles and antiparticles. Okay, and so that again is parallel to this step over here. These are my fermions here, and by giving the representation of the algebra in the Hilbert space, I'm specifying the representation of the fermions under the automorphisms of that algebra. But then step three, so this is important, there's no step three. So over here, there was a third step where I had to specify the Higgs field, the scalar fields, the list of scalar fields and their charges as an independent input. Over here, that's not how it goes. Over here, once you specify the algebra and its representation on the Hilbert space. So in other words, what you would have naively thought of as the symmetries and gauge bosons and the fermions, then the Higgs field is not an independently specifiable thing. It is then, there is a crank you turn to figure out what are the gauge bosons. What are the gauge bosons in this case? And but because the space is slightly non-commutative, it's as if the gauge field has a new component, which in the normal interpretation is a scalar field. So just like in the normal story, once you specify this gauge group, we don't have to ask any additional question about, you know, what are the gauge bosons or what representation do they transform in. They have to transform in the adjoint here. Over here, once we've done this, we That's true for both the scalar field and the gauge bosons. Yeah. When? That's right. That's right. For the representation that gives you the right fermion charges, you then get as an output that the Higgs. So that ends up coming from this from the structure of the space that the geometry that we take as an ansatz here is this product space between it's a product between the continuous spacetime and the there's this process by which you generate the connection that you have to add to D to make it, okay, roughly speaking, covariant with respect to automorphisms of this algebra. I'll say more correctly what you do in a minute, but and what you get when you do that so this D has two bits because we're taking the product of two spaces. The D on the product space is a product of two parts and because this D naturally has an index in it, somehow it has this structure. When you fluctuate and end up finding that you have to add something here for covariance sake, it automatically has that same index. Just automatically has to have it. Over here, there is no such index lying around. This is merely a matrix on the finite dimensional space. So when you ask when you just look, you do an argument exactly analogous to ordinary gauge theory when you're trying to figure out what gauge bosons, what you have to add to a partial derivative to make it into a covariant derivative. Then you find you have to add something here that's like a space-time dependent thing times a finite matrix. But there's nothing for the index to contract with. I mean, there's no way for an index to enter. The only thing that can appear here is a scalar field, and that is what appears when you do the fluctuation. Okay. So now I'm going to turn it over to Shane in a minute input. Sadly. The Yukawa couplings are the okay. So I said in non-commutative geometry, you specify a space by giving these three elements. So now the space that is going to describe the standard model coupled to gravity is the product of two non-commutative geometries. One is the canonical one. In the canonical one, the canonical one gives back continuous spacetime. So it's the algebra of continuous functions over some manifold, the curved space Dirac operator over that manifold, and H is going to be space of square integrable spinners over that manifold. But then we are going to take the product of that with a finite dimensional space. So all of this was an infinite dimensional algebra acting on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. But then I'm just going to take a finite dimensional space, some finite dimensional algebra AF, that's this thing, acting on some finite dimensional Hilbert space, HF, which is this thing. And then DF, the finite dimensional quote-unquote Dirac operator, is just the most general Hermitian operator, Hermitian 96 by 96 matrix, that you can write down that is consistent with a list of axioms, which I'm going to say can be summarized as a much simpler axiom in a minute. But so just all the free parameters in that matrix are, turn out to be exactly the Yukawa parameters. So you don't have any fewer, you don't determine those parameters. They're still undetermined parameters. It's just they have a new different interpretation.
But you're still waiting in the fact that you have, there are fewer free parameters than you would have if you were writing down the standard model.
Just barely. It is claimed that when you the normal approach to taking a geometry and turning it into an action, in other words, the non-commutative analog of the Einstein-Hilbert action, which takes a geometry and spits out a real number, is something called the spectral action. And that's some formula. If you just apply it to this geometry, it spits out a real number, and that's exactly the claim, that if you plug in this geometry, that thing spits out the standard model coupled to gravity, but with three extra constraints between parameters that you wouldn't expect on the basis of just effective field theory using those. So that's true. For normalization group flow. Yes. Well, so that's exactly why that's exactly right. So you get these extra constraints on parameters, and they are not stable under, you get these three extra constraints and then they're not preserved by the normal RG flow. I don't know, there's different ways to think about that. But I was going to say one of the things I'm excited about is that there could be another way, a better way to get an action out that doesn't suffer from this problem. In other words, there's two aspects of this standard model from non-commutative geometry story. The part that I am enthusiastic about, this part, that's what I would call the kinematic part. It's the part where you, just given the geometric structure, can determine what are the particles present, what are their representations under the gauge group, and so forth. But then there is this other thing, the spectral action. Which is the current formula for converting that into an action formula, converting a geometry into an action formula, and that part, I just think it has less evidence in favor of it being correct, and both observational and theoretical, and that theoretical argument you said suggests it's not really can't be really the whole story. So that's part of what I wanted to say was that. This thing about this development of this recent paper is one of the things it does is maybe suggest a better possibility. So let me just
quickly, can you, if there will be like two cases still, would it be possible to unregister like by slightly changing the algebra or something?
That's very possible. So I don't claim that the standard model is the unique model you can predict or anything like this. I'm not even sure I claim that it's the unique model that would have the standard model list of fermions. In other words, I merely want to say that the Higgs sector is much more constrained. It's very far from being an independent input once you've specified the previous two. It's highly constrained. But I don't have a classification theorem that says if I search over all possible guys, is this the only case where, if I get the standard model fermions right, do I have to get the scalar Higgs boson right? Yeah. Yeah, there are three generations of fermions. Sorry. When I was listing here, because the table just repeats for the three fermions. That's why I said one generation. But the actual geometry that is constructed is for three generations. When I said 96 dimensional, that was counting the three from. There's a factor of three in there from. Just tripling. Yes, that's three generations is an unexplained input, but it is a possible. It does not change the Higgs sector. Just like when you add three generations of fermions in normal gauge theory, it doesn't change the gauge boson sector. The Higgs is really like another component of the gauge boson that appears in the non-commutative case.
Wasn't that written there over the matrix when you wrote the algebra?
I was denoting an element of this algebra. Lambda is a complex number. Q is a quaternion. I briefly thought about populating this matrix with lambdas and Qs to show you what it looked like. But anyway, I'm not going to do that. because I'm beginning to I'm running into Shane's talk here. So you know, I think I just want to try to quickly say say the story about what we did, and then how they improved upon it, and then just say a word or two about, you know, a couple things that seem interesting about it. So you know, our starting point was that we were interested in trying to generalize non-commutative geometry to non-associative geometry. And so the first thing you do in non-commutative geometry is represent an algebra on a Hilbert space. And what would that even mean if the algebra was non-associative? Because normally when you say representing something, you mean mapping the elements to matrices, and then matrix multiplication is associative, so how could that possibly represent the algebra? Okay, so we found our way to an answer due to Eilenberg, the mathematician who invented category theory back in the 40s and 50s. Well, so around the same time he gave this nice definition for what it means to represent an algebra on a Hilbert space. He said, okay, it's nothing but a new algebra A plus H, where at the level of vector space, it's just the sum of the vector space A and the vector space H. But then I'm going to equip it. I need to tell you what is the product on that algebra. Let me just back up and say I should have said first. Just so we're on the same page. So what is an algebra? An algebra A is just a vector space that is equipped with a product where you can a bilinear product from A times A. To A. So you can take the product of two elements of an algebra and get another element. You take the product of two vectors and get another vector. So matrices are an example of an algebra. You can add them so they form a vector space, but you can also multiply them so they form an algebra. Functions over some space are a commutative algebra. So the suggestion is you introduce this new algebra B, which is A plus H. And I still have to tell you what is the product on this guy. And the answer is for any two elements in B naught, their product, so these two guys can both be written as, this guy can be written as A plus H, and this guy can be written as A prime plus H prime, where these are the A's are from A and the H's are from H. The product here is A prime plus H prime plus H. A prime, where, in other words, this product is the product inherited from A, so the product lies in A. This product is a new bilinear product that I define. It lies in H. This is another bilinear product that I define. It lies in H. And then the product of H times H prime is defined to be zero. So let's define a representation to be that. And then he says, oh, well, then notice that in the normal associative definition of a representation then is recovered by simply demanding that B0 is an associative algebra. Okay, so what I mean by that is, you know, if you demanding that this thing is an associative algebra, well, that means that I have to demand that the product of three elements from A associates. So from there, I recover the usual assumption that A is associative. Alternatively, I have to demand that the product of two elements of A and an element of H associates. Well, but then if you think about it, that's really nothing but the usual condition that this left action that I've defined here, this bilinear product from A times H into H, is a representation in the normal sense. Similarly, the associator where I have H times two A's, that's the standard definition of a right representation of A on H. And the associator where I have two A's surrounding an H says that the right action and left action commute with each other. So that's exactly the definition of an associative bimodule. And then in the case where H A identically vanishes, that's the definition of a left representation, or alternatively, in the case where AH identically vanishes. That's the usual definition of a write action. Okay, so that's nice. And there's a way in which already it's kind of interesting that if you turn the logic around, if you just demand that B is associative, this algebra B not is associative, you recover four of the things you traditionally assume about non-commutative geometry, that the algebra A is associative, that it's left associatively represented on the Hilbert space, that it's right associatively represented, and that the left and right actions commute. So this is normally called the so-called order zero axiom. So then the next thing we noticed was that, it's important in non-commutative geometry that A here is not just an algebra, it's a star algebra. So it's equipped with a conjugation operation, like the complex numbers are an example of a star algebra, or with complex conjugation as the star, or matrices, n by n matrices over the complex numbers, where dagger is the star operation. That's an example of a star algebra. So this is some anti-linear automorphism of the algebra. So in particular, it's supposed to map. The star of two elements is supposed to preserve their product but reverse the order. So how do we represent that? Well, turns out in this context, it's easy. If we just assume that B is not just an associative algebra, but an associative star algebra, well, then it turns out that we reproduce a bunch more, like six more of the traditional bits of structure of non-commutative geometry. And I'm not going to say what those are, because I think maybe Shane will hit them later. And if he doesn't, maybe that's not a big problem. So that was working great. It seemed to very nicely capture the structure of normal non-commutative geometry, but naturally generalized to the non-associative case. When I say that, I mean like, so what if this had been a non-associative algebra, Jordan algebra, or the Actonians, or something? Well, if this was a Jordan algebra, then the definition of a representation of a Jordan algebra would just be to demand that B naught is also a Jordan algebra. So it generalizes to the non-associative case, captures already a sizable list of the traditional bits of ordinary non-commutative geometry, more succinctly. But we haven't yet included D. We've only talked about A and H. So to include D, we had to represent omega A on H. And so the question, we had to represent omega A, I should say. So omega A is the algebra of differential forms over A. So there is some natural notion of differential forms over an algebra, even in the non-commutative case. So this is some non-commutative generalization, even in the non-associative case, the generalization of the ordinary exterior algebra. So here we get to the heart of the issue. So what does it mean to represent this, and what do we represent it on? Well, we suggested that we define the following algebra. We just replaced A by omega A here, and we continued to represent it on H. And so again, if we demanded that B was an associative and graded star algebra, we reproduced an even longer list of NCG axioms. And then there were a bunch of physics payoffs that came at this stage. There were several assumptions that previously had to been put in by hand in the ordinary construction of the standard model. Well, there's one assumption that had to be put in by hand called the important assumption called the massless photon condition. There are some extra terms in the matrix DF that have to be killed in order to get the standard model. Previously, one had to make up a non-geometrical assumption to kill those, but now they die as a function as a consequence of the associativity of B. And then also from the physics standpoint, the automorphisms of B, now there's now a real, I kept having to hem and haw when I said the automorphisms of A corresponded to the symmetries of the theory, but now it's really true with no hemming and hawing. The symmetries are now just the automorphisms of this algebra B, and you end up predicting the standard model plus a slight extension. There's two new fields. One scalar field, which is a singlet under the usual standard model gauge group. Well, I should say, first new field is that there's a new gauge boson B mu nu, which is carries B minus L. And the second new field is a scalar field, which is only charged under B minus L. And then this is the thing that Higgs is this, which is why we don't observe it at low energy. So it's a, it predicts a slight extension of the standard model, a phenomenologically viable one, provided this VEV is this, this guy obtains a sufficiently large VEV. And in and the presence of this new field solves the traditional problem, the non-commutative geometry with when it, in the old way of doing it, when it was thought that it just produced one Higgs field, had a problem where it predicted the wrong mass for the Higgs field. It predicted 170 GeV, and then it was, then that was ruled out observationally. So in the two-field Higgs, in the two-field model, that ends up not being there's no conflict with experiment like that. Unfortunately, no. Yeah. That's right. There's enough freedom. Obviously it would be much nicer if I said, "Oh, we changed it, and then it predicted the right value, bang on, or something like that." But no, it's just that there's, because there's a larger Higgs sector, there's more parametric freedom in the. Say it again.
I mean, if you already take the value that is according to the existing prediction, then the remaining part, the values of the main parameters, is it other verifiable or classifiable, or is it just the game that can be always played?
That's a good question, of course. I think the answer is that we don't. Yeah, but we don't actually get a prediction for the others. We don't get a prediction for the other scalar field's exact mass. But the only thing to add though is that we already know it has to be so heavy that it could maybe have cosmological implications. But it's to be phenomenologically viable, the mass of that particle has to be up so high that you wouldn't be able to see it at the LHC or something like that, unfortunately. Okay, sorry. I really got to get out of the way to let Shane go here. I was just going to say, so in order to, the only way to make this, regard this algebra as graded was we ended up having to assign the infinity grading to this thing. Now that should have been a sign that something funny was going on. And then we found out that, so this thing is a differential graded algebra. Remember last time it was important that this thing was a star algebra, and we didn't forget about that star structure. We preserved it in the representation when we went to B. We demanded that B have that same structure, that it's also a star algebra. Here, this thing is a differential graded star algebra, meaning it's a very nice kind of algebra with a bunch of extra structure. We would like to preserve all of that in B, but we weren't able to do that. Instead, okay, we were able to make this a graded algebra, but only if we gave this weird grading of infinity. And then we were not able to. There are junk forms, so-called junk forms, we weren't able to get rid of in order to make it a proper differential graded algebra. So that was one of the key problems here, the nagging things we couldn't get. And then the other problem was that I said that demanding associativity gave extra constraints that solve this massless photon, remove that massless photon condition. But unfortunately, they also give extra constraints that seem to rule out the ordinary continuous geometry that gives back Riemannian geometry. It seemed to give an extra condition that was inconsistent with ordinary Riemannian geometry. Okay, so the basic insight of in that Bruder et al. Paper is that at the same time that you're promoting this thing, when you from normal algebra to a differential graded algebra, you should not just be representing it on the same old space you were representing it on before, but you should also promote this thing to some graded structure. Okay, so somehow they represent this now, not on H, but on some graded. Graded vector space, then they do get a nice graded algebra without this having to do this business with the grading, and then they can also consistently mod out the junk and get a differential graded algebra, and then as soon as they've done that, the former incompatibility with the continuous space, with the normal commutative manifold, is it goes away. So whereas the nice properties of the previous construction are retained. So it really is a beautiful fix. And so, you know, now, maybe just in quick summary, I'll just say Eilenberg's approach really adapts beautifully to this. If we had just, from the outset, demanded that B naught not just be an associative star algebra, but an associative star, you know, differential graded algebra, and not put up with letting ourselves declared it illegal to use the grading infinity, like any good mathematician would have told us to do, then we would have been led to exactly this structure. It really is beautiful. I haven't had a chance to explain it, but it's beautiful how it just adapts, this construction adapts perfectly. So I want to say this is the basic structure, and in 2 seconds, one reason it's exciting is because Laurent has been telling me for years that, you know, oh, he likes Kahn's non-commutative geometry, but it should be phase space that he's making non-commutative, not ordinary space-time. And so, you know, the space that they are led to represent on here is really another copy of this thing mod the junk. So there is a sense in which it looks a lot like they have been led to do exactly what you wanted them to do. They have the algebra describing space-time, and then just to represent it, the most natural thing that comes out is to exactly double that algebra, and then demand compatibility of those two parts. So I thought Laurent would like that. And then the other point is just that there is this so-called there's this well-developed formalism, the so-called BRST formalism, or BV formalism, which was developed for trying to understand how to consistently quantize gauge theories. And you know, at a formal level, it is some machine basically that takes differential graded algebras as inputs and spits out an action and their quantization as outputs. And so, it makes it. This is something that I should say that is emphasized by Bruder in their paper, and I think it's a really nice suggestion that it makes it seem like there is another route instead of using the spectral action to go from a geometry to a action formula. There's this other route to get there, which seems very interesting. And you know, we're just at the beginning of thinking about that. And my impression is that those guys are too. But anyway, so it's as usual, I went about a vector or two longer than intended. Can I hand over, or is it implausible that what you were going to say is sayable in the
want, but we can continue if you want.
maybe I can ask it.
Part of this perfect intellectual meal, we can just continue.
Should we do that? I don't know.
There's some event here, some psi thing, so we can do it until then. Or
where's it been? Can you hear that? All right, thank you, Latham, and thank you everyone for coming along to listen to what we have to talk about today. I'm not gonna go for an hour, so what I'm gonna do is give part two of this informal discussion covering some of the work that we've been doing over the past two or so years. And eventually, If I do have enough time, I want to get to a discussion of some work I've been doing on the Bruder et al. Paper over the past two or so weeks. So it's unfinished work, it's rather uncooked, and if it makes your bellies sick, I apologize, but that's the goal. And so to begin with, I just want to give a bit of a recap. What have we been doing? So Lathan and I have been developing a reformulation of Alain Kohn's non-commutative differential geometry with what we claim are two benefits. Okay, so the first benefit is that this reformulation is more appropriately applied to answering problems in particle theory. Right? And I'll talk about that later in my talk. The second benefit is that it more naturally generalizes to non-associative differential geometry. And in particular, you might be able to describe non-associative geometries which are useful for describing beyond the standard model physics. So those are the two benefits. And you know, our reformulation has already seen two successes. So as Lathan described, when you apply it to the finite part of the standard model, you gain new restrictions or new constraints on the Higgs sector. Right? And the second benefit, as Lathan also described, or the second success, is that many of Kohn's axioms or conditions may be, in some sense, derived from a smaller number of more fundamental axioms or conditions. But again, as Lathan described, there are some problems. So our formalism, it worked very well in the finite part of the standard model, but not on the continuous part. And so recently, this paper by Nadir and his colleagues fixed up some of these problems and made our construction more general so that it can describe the full standard model, not just the finite part. So. Oh.
Discuss any of this with Cole Curie because
you have
she's putting in a non-associative algebra in right at the beginning.
Right. Yeah, I've had quite a few discussions with Cole, but we haven't worked on anything together yet. But actually, for the whole talk, I'm going to stick to the associative case. It just so happens the formalism is more naturally generalizable to the non-associative case. But I should state that at the outset, this entire talk is associative.
Is this non-associated part related number
released? Oh, is there a paper?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We have an examples paper where we construct non-associative geometries, which should be coming out very shortly.
Cool.
And most of what we've done so far does generalize very readily. And we discuss it briefly in our papers. So the last two letters, which are on the archive that you can find. Both to discuss in brief detail the non-associative case. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to discuss this reformulation, and in particular, I'm going to try to focus, if I have time, on the work of Nadir and his colleagues. And I'm going to do what Lathan did. I'm going to explain, I'm going to give some motivation, I'm going to explain what non-commutative geometry is, what our reformulation is. I'm going to try to fill in the gaps that Lathan sort of rushed over and not explained so much the details that he did go over. Okay, so to start with, I want to give some motivation. So that's part one of my talk. In the second part, I want to describe our reformulation. So Shane and Latham's reformulation of non-commutative geometry. And because he's here, I'm just going to call part three Nadir's bit. So Nadir's non-commutative geometry. And then.
Wow. We already had the motivation. Can you jump to the part 2.5?
I'll go quickly over this. There are people in the room who haven't heard this as much as you. So, but I'll try to go as quickly. Yeah. So, okay, I'll go quickly over the first part. But okay, and then finally, in part four, I want to discuss something that may seem to be a bit of a technical detail, but it's the involution that Lathan discussed at the end. Right? We want to construct differential graded algebras, or we want to construct involutive differential graded algebras, and these involutions are actually quite important in the construction. And although it may seem like a technical detail, it's important when you're trying to constrain gauge theories that you construct as non-commutative differential geometries. So if I get time, I'll talk about involutions at the end. So I'll give exceptionally quick motivation. but I want to give this motivation because it's kind of cute and it can be explained to a high school student. Right, so why on earth should the people in this room care about geometry? And in particular, why should you care about the type of geometry that Lathan and I are trying to push on you? And because I want to target this motivation at a high school student, imagine back to when you were a high school student sitting in a math exam where the teacher came and gave you some problem set on geometry. They would have given you some ordered lines, some circles, maybe some triangles. And as input, they would have provided some subset of the side lengths and angles in these problems. And the goal of the exam was you were supposed to prove how much you knew about geometry, right, by going ahead and determining what the missing side lengths and angles were in the problem. Right, this is, you wouldn't have used this language, but what they wanted you to do is use the axioms or the rules of Euclidean geometry to infer some output data given some input data. And this is generally what Euclidean geometry is good for. Right, every day around the world, surveyors go about and they measure the height of really tall buildings without having to construct enormous rulers and hold them up to the side of the wall, right? So they have some optical instrument and they have a working knowledge of Euclidean geometry, right? So the idea is that you can use geometry to infer some missing information without having to directly go and measure it. And so we use Euclidean geometry, and it's useful in our everyday lives because it's appropriate for describing the world on human scales. The speeds we're used to traveling at, and the distances that we're accustomed to. But say you wanted to describe some larger distances. Say you wanted to describe the universe, or you wanted to describe, you know, a situation where you're sitting very close to a black hole, or you're traveling at very high velocities, then perhaps a more appropriate geometry to use is a Riemannian geometry. Okay? And Riemannian geometry has the same feature, right? Cosmologists and astrophysicists are very familiar with inferring information about the curvature of space-time, which sits in between us and some lens galaxy, right? And so the question is, can we do the same for particle physics? Is there some appropriate geometry which describes gauge theories, right? Because if there is, then presumably we can use the axioms of this geometry together with information about particles we've already detected to infer information about particles which may be out of the range of our current detectors. So that would be like a lofty dream, right? So why should you be interested in non-commutative differential geometry as a physicist? It's because you can get information without having to physically go there and measure it. And of course, this would direct your experiment. It wouldn't replace it. Okay, so that's the motivation for why you should, that's my motivation anyway, for why you should listen to this talk. Sorry, Laurent, it's done. It's gone. And I'll do this one just as quickly. Okay, so what is non-commutative differential geometry and how do Lathan and I reformulate it? Okay, so again, when you're constructing any geometry, you have to start by providing some input data. And so as Lathan said, when you're constructing a Riemannian geometry, you start by providing a manifold and a metric. But then what Alain Kahn and his collaborators, such as Matilda, and others did is they came along and they said, well, what you can do is instead you can describe these Riemannian geometries in terms of a dual set of input data, in terms of a so-called spectral triple. This data is given in terms of an algebra, a Dirac operator, a Hilbert space, a real structure and grading. And Lathan described these elements in a tiny bit of detail, and I'm not going to go much further. The important thing to note is that for a very special set of data, you can reconstruct Riemannian manifolds and vice versa. And why would you be interested in this really confusing, complicated language? Well, the answer is that once you've described geometries in this language, this algebra need not be commutative anymore. And Lathan and I say that it need not be associative even. Hence, non-commutative differential geometry. Right? Okay, so in Lathan's motivation, he said that the reason why you should be interested in non-commutative geometry, so the practical reason, is because non-commutative differential geometry allows you to construct gauge theories in a way that you can place additional constraints, geometric constraints. And in particular, he discussed the Stern model of particle physics, where he said, you know, once you've specified the fermions and the Gaze bosons in your model, then in some sense, the Higgs fields, or the Higgs sector, comes out as output. And so I'm just going to sort of flesh that out a tiny little bit, just so you can see sort of where that comes from. So when you're constructing a gauge theory as a non-commutative differential geometry, your bosonic input data sits inside A and D, roughly speaking. So this holds information about your Higgs and your gauge fields, right? Whereas your fermionic input data sits over here. When you're reconstructing Riemannian geometries, the input data that you have has to satisfy certain constraints, certain axioms, right? And you take these constraints as axiom and generalize them slightly in the non-commutative case. And it's these conditions which give you additional constraints on your models. Right, so I'm just going to write down 8 important ones for this talk. You don't need to know exactly what they mean. You just need to know that they exist. Right, and they're going to be important for the talk. Right, the Dirac operator, you ask that it's Hermitian. You ask that the Dirac operator commutes with the real structure up to plus minus 1. So it commutes or any commutes, sorry. It any commutes with the grading. And there's what is called the order 1 condition. Right. And there's 4 others that have no D in them. So these are the conditions that you'd impose to place constraints on D. There are 4 others that I want to talk about. So the real structure squares to plus or minus 1. It commutes or any commutes with the grading. There's a definition of the right action, which Latham described, of algebra elements on the Hilbert space. And there's an order 0 condition. Right. The point is, once you've specified your fermionic input data, right, H, J, gamma, and your gauge bosonic input data, roughly speaking, the algebra, then these conditions here single out what your Dirac operator has to be, right? And for the standard model, roughly speaking, once you've input the standard model fermions and gauge bosonic input data, you get the Higgs sector of the standard model. But not quite. As Latham said, you get a little bit too many particles. You get the Higgs sector plus some unwanted fields which are not viable. And so what people do essentially is they remove them by hand. Okay? But you shouldn't worry about that because Latham and I have fixed that problem. So that's my introduction to non-commutative geometry. Now, Laurent, this everything from here is as you want it. Okay. All right, so what did Latham and I do? We took the input data of non-commutative differential geometry. And we redescribed it in terms of algebras, which originally we called fused algebras, but which mathematicians call square zero extensions, or just extensions of the input algebra A. So roughly speaking, because we want to do physics, you need to be able to describe gauge potentials and the like. And so what you do is from A and D, as Latham described, you construct some differential graded algebra, omega D, of A. And you bi-represent that on the Hilbert space H. And so our original construction was that we form, as Latham described, some algebra B, which has this structure here. Right? Everyone remembers this from the previous talk, or do you want me to go over how this is constructed? Okay, I'm gonna assume you remember from the last talk. Okay, so what Nadir and his colleagues did is they said, look, Shane and Latham, you're really silly. You know, why are you constructing this differential graded algebra here but not representing on a differential graded bimodule? So they replace in Latham's notation, or their notation actually, the representation with a differential graded representation. Okay, that's the content essentially of their paper. Why is that important? Well, I'll show you. As Latham described, if you want the standard model of particle physics as it's constructed as a non-commutative differential geometry to be associative, then this algebra here has to be associative, right? And so this imposes additional constraints. And he wrote down, the only ones I'm going to be talking about in this talk is the following constraint. And if I take some n form, right, this is an element of omega m of a, or n of a, sorry, and I represent that on a Hilbert space element, it should associate with m forms. Right? Now, in our construction, h was not graded, so I don't have to worry about its grading. And when you, in our construction, the involution on algebra elements is given as follows. So this is, did you describe that in your talk? Did you? Oh, I'm going to have to introduce that. OK, I'll introduce that. Yeah. OK, Latham didn't describe this, so I'll describe it quickly. The way that we extend the involution from omega d of A to the full differential graded algebra B is by use of the unitary anti-linear operator J, which is called the real structure, this element here. All right. So we simply defined in our formalism. So again, this is in the case where h is not graded. This is our original formalism prior to Nadir. We defined our involution in this way. Right? Now, the involution has to satisfy the following properties. Right? If I take any two elements of a general algebra, A and B, and I take their involution, the involution satisfies B star, A star. So what the involution does is it allows us to construct right actions in terms of left actions, right, because it flips the ordering. Right. So this commutator with two brackets, I think Latham described it as, you didn't define it? OK, my apologies. No, so I'll define it now. This is the difficult thing about doing a two-part talk. I don't know exactly what Latham's going to say, so I can't.
It did turn out to be. We've learned our lesson. You know,
okay, but so in any case, so that's the associator. We defined the involution in this way, and what that does for you is it allows you to define the right action of the forms. Right? So roughly speaking, the forms, the right action of, well, I'll define the left action first, because you don't know that. So the left action of an exact form, right, if my representation pi of d of a, so my representation of d of a on h is defined to be da on h. This is how I construct my exact one forms. Right? Now, to represent the right action, I can use my involution. Right. I just use this involution property here. So the right action immediately derives from our definition of the involution here. Okay. So what we can do now is we can substitute this definition for the left and right action up into here for forms of all orders. And what you get is three conditions. First condition that you get, if you want to write it out explicitly, is as follows. You get that zero forms have to commute with the right action of zero forms. Right? I've just got the left action and the right action of zero forms here. But this, as you'll note, is just Kohn's order zero condition. It just arises as an associativity condition on the algebra B. The second condition that you have is that one forms or exact one forms have to associate with zero forms on the Hilbert space, which gives you another condition, dA. Right, this is just the left action of an exact one form. This is just Kohn's order one condition, right? And then you continue. You know, one forms have to associate with one forms if you want the algebra itself to be associative. But that gives you an additional condition which people did not impose. Right? This is a higher order condition which people did not impose in the traditional approach to noncommutative differential geometry. But if you want your formalism to be associative, then it seems, at first sight, this is what you should be imposing. And you impose it, and what it does is it kills off all the unwanted terms in the Dirac operator. So it kills off all the unwanted fields that you don't want. It kills off all the unwanted scalar fields that previously people removed by hand. Yeah? So you'd represent them like this. So in the traditional approach, what happens is you get the Stenemol Higgs plus some additional fields which are unwanted. And what people did is they just removed them by hand. What we showed is that if you want your formalism to be associative, you actually get an additional constraint that people weren't imposing. And it's exactly this constraint that kills off the extra terms. So it makes the formalism compatible, or the finite part of the Stenemol model compatible with phenomenology, what you would expect. Is that? Okay, so this is the extra condition I want to talk about. It actually changes in Nadir's formalism, right? And I'll show you why. So the problem with this construction, it looks very successful, right? You apply it to the Stenemol model of particle physics, at least the finite part, and you rederive a bunch of Kohn's axioms which were previously given as input. You get the right action that you got for zero forms. You get a higher order, the right action for higher order forms. You get additional conditions. You get the phenomenology you want. The problem is that this condition here is not satisfied by the continuous part of the Stenemol model. So just pure Riemannian geometries do not satisfy this condition. So that says either two things. Either Riemannian geometries correspond to non-associative differential geometries, or alternatively, we've made a mistake in our assumptions. And what Nadir and his colleagues showed was it was the second option. So is that clear to everyone? Is there any questions? Okay, so what Nadir and his colleagues did was they said, instead of representing on H, what you should be representing on is some graded bimodule. Right? And what they did is then they derived what the right action should be. Rather than assuming the form of the involution, they derived what the right action should be, and it is as follows. I won't go through that derivation, because it takes a lot of time. But the right action, so if I take, their vector space is now graded. So if I want to construct the right action of a form, of an M form on an element of omega n of h, then they derive the following. So they derive this right action, and what you can see immediately is it differs from the right action that we defined. So our right action was following. So their right action is the same as ours, except depending on the order that you're acting on, you pick up a plus or a minus sign. And these plus or minus signs are actually quite crucial. Right? So you can take the definition for the right action. You use it to write out this term explicitly. And what you find is the following. At order 0, their right action is the same as ours. So the order 0 and order 1 conditions, right, which have the right action of 0 forms, don't change. But the higher order conditions, this condition here, changes. You pick up an extra minus sign. And so this condition here, if you take care of the grading, turns into an any commutator condition. Now, rather remarkably, when you apply this to the finite part of the center model, it imposes the exact same constraints as the commutator condition. Because the constraint that it imposes is that, when you work it out, it imposes that dA dB equals 0. Right? And so both are satisfied. What have I assumed? I've assumed which grading? The one on the bimodule? So I've assumed that the algebra that you construct B is a differential graded algebra, right? And that when I take the product of elements.
Yeah, I know that. But to get this result here, with the anti-commutator, what's the grade of the bimodule?
Bimodule. What do you mean?
Well, is it a homogeneous grade or is it?
I don't know what that means.
Okay. You've got a graded bimodule. What is it?
So that's something that hasn't been clarified. So we don't actually know what the representation space is. And
is that for all n or for which n or what?
Is
that depends on m and n there. So right, hn right. Is an element of
So these equations on there with the anti commutator.
So this this is always true. Yeah. Right. Do you want me to do it explicitly? Because I'll do it explicitly if you want, but it takes a little bit of time.
You said your thing has a commutator.
Yep.
And your thing is when n to zero
in there. So the statement is. Previously, we didn't take any account of the grading on the representation space. And we took the naive definition for the involution, this one here. Right? And if you simply take this definition, right, and plug it into this equation up here, then you get a commutator.
Previously, you were assuming n equals 0. But even if n equals 0, you have extra signs epsilon m that you need to take into account.
We weren't assuming that the grading is 0 before. We weren't assuming before that the representation space was just made up of, you know, we weren't assigning and grading at all to them.
Looking at the case where you're with n on the right and then the left with a 1 form. So if you start with a 0 form in the middle, when you act the first one, it turns it into a 1 form. So then the next guy is not acting a 0 form, it's acting a 1 form. So this is an extra sign that comes from that. Is that clear? Both of them are not acting on a 0 form. One of them is always has to be acting on 1 form. First action turns
to
0 form
into
1 form,
so
the next
I can just show you explicitly if you want.
At m and n equals 0.
Yeah.
Why it looks like the first is the same as the second, if you have m and n is your relation.
Right. Well, when you set m and
n.
I see what you mean. Yeah, okay. Thank you. So, in the case where m is set to 0, then this is no longer a 1 form, it's a 0 form, and you go back to the order 0 conditions. Thank you. So the order of h, the order n, this doesn't matter. N doesn't matter at all. It can be anything. M is the only thing that matters here. Yeah. Sorry. Thank you. Okay, so yeah, you're right. You go back to a commutator expression because you're looking at these conditions. Okay, so anyway, to wrap this up, when you look at this new anti-commutator relation, it holds for the full center model. So it holds the finite part and the continuous part. So that's the important point. But what I wanted to talk about today, which I'm not going to talk about, I'm just going to write down the answer, is in the way that they did things, they didn't actually define an involution. Right? They derived a right action independent of the involution. I'm not going to go through that derivation. It took several assumptions, such as associativity. Right? And we want to construct a formalism which is which doesn't rely on the associativity. Right? And so to define right actions, we really need to be able to define an involution. And so I'm just going to give you the answer. But the involution that you should take, which seems to make sense, and gives you exactly the same right action as Bruder et al., is as follows. So you can actually derive this, but I'm not going to derive it. There are actually two cases. It's not unique, this convention. But if you take this definition for your involution, the whole argument that we had before follows through, and you get the exact same any commutator that Bruder and Al did. So that's roughly what I want to speak to you guys about today, unless you want me to show you the derivation of that. That's basically what I was planning on saying.
So we don't have a lot of time for questions. There are already besides students gathering up there.
Oh, okay.
And there are already a lot of questions.
Zero.
What about this remark about phase space? Is there a short way to say that? In what sense, I think this grading on H is compatible with this doubling?
It's a bit of a longer story than we can tell right now. I mean, in light of the fact that we're over, I think we should talk so well.
So do we know from the standard one what the grading of the binary is?
As in, you want me to fix the grading? No,
we just leave it general for now. We don't. I mean, this was the proposal.
Well, in terms of path, you write down basis for the path.
So that's not how they do it. They don't take the biomodule just over H. They don't just take the normal page and split it up into a great integrated substrate. They take copies of H or copies of B of H as the representations. Multiple copies. They just keep track of the grade because they equip it with an extra label which keeps track of the grade.
Oh, I see. Sorry.
Sorry, not complete. I wouldn't say we have a very
the same particle appears in the time.
Or that's one possible way that it can be done, or another way to do it, which is the way they mentioned this fact, but there's a bunch of different ways.